To introduce this evening's distinguished speaker, we're fortunate to have with us a former student of Professor Sokolow, Dr. Tracy Ivey. Dr. Ivey is a National Science Foundation postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Zurich. This is the third time the NSF has acknowledged and supported her research. She worked with Professor Paul Ward there, one of the world's preeminent scholars of polyandry and insects. She earned both her master's degree in 1998 and doctoral degree in 2005 from Illinois State University with mentorship from Dr. Sokolow. She published the first chapter of her dissertation, a groundbreaking paper on the adaptive significance of polyandry in the prestigious journal Evolution. She's also published her work in Proceedings of the Royal Society of London, the Journal of Evolutionary Biology, and in Animal Behavior. And I learned this evening that she's on her way to another postdoctoral appointment at the University of Rochester. Dr. Ivey.
Introduction, Provost Presley, and thanks to everyone for being here today. I'm really, really honored to be here tonight to introduce distinguished Professor Scott Sokolow. I met Scott, as Provost Presley said, it was a little over 12 years ago now when I somehow convinced him to accept me as a master's student. And then I later went on and did my PhD work with him as my advisor as well. I'm really grateful for all of the excellent guidance that Scott has given me throughout the years in both my professional life as well as sometimes my personal life as well. And I'm just very proud to call him my mentor and my friend. And I'm sure that I express what many of you here feel tonight when I say that I'm just so happy to see Scott receive this honor. He richly deserves it. Scott has earned his bachelor's and master's degrees from Brock University in Canada, and then he went on to do his PhD in zoology at the University of Toronto, graduating in 1986. I'm sure that Scott wouldn't have known way back then that he would be standing before you tonight, being branded as distinguished. But here he is, and after these days as a student, he cleaned himself up, got a haircut, and joined the faculty of the Department of Biological Sciences here at ISU in 1987. Just this year, he was named the Director of Research and Sponsored Programs at Illinois State University. So he's here looking much more distinguished in these days. Scott has consistently set himself apart, not only by doing first-rate research in behavioral ecology and evolutionary biology, but also by being an incredible teacher and mentor to many, many students. He has authored about 60 scientific papers in peer-reviewed journals, as well as several book chapters, and he's received well over $1 million in federal grant funding for his research. So even though he didn't become the musician that he dreamed of being when he was a young guy, he can still live the glamorous rock star life that he imagined. Scott has been the major professor of 15 graduate students, past and present, and all of the students who have had Scott as an advisor have published one or more papers resulting from their research. He's also mentored several undergraduates, many of also who have published papers as well. He's served many students outside of his laboratory serving as the faculty advisor for the Phi Sigma Biological Honor Society and has served on many, many committees for PhD and master's students in the department. Many of Scott's students, past and present, are here this evening, which is a testament to his talent and commitment as a mentor. Tonight, Scott will talk to us about his 20-plus years of research here at ISU involving the conflict between the sexes. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Distinguished Professor of Biological Sciences, Dr. Scott Sacklett.
By asking, who is the smiling man in this picture, and why does he have his arm around my watch? I can't answer the second question, but I can tell you that his name is Jeff Parker. He's one of the preeminent theorists in biology today. And in a paper that he published in 1979, a kind of an obscure book, he established or provided the theoretical underpinnings for an entire branch of evolutionary biology, which is formally known as sexual conflict theory. Sexual conflict begins with the recognition that when it comes to fundamental reproductive decisions that individuals involved in a sexual relationship, that their interests may diverge with respect to who to mate with, how much parental care to invest in their shared offspring, which of a female's several mates, sperm, should she use to fertilize her eggs. And this type of conflict is almost automatic whenever you have a species where either of the individual's sexes mates not monogamously, polygamously. And just to sort of capture this in a very sort of understandable way, you can imagine that it is always or normally in the best reproductive interest of the male to mate with more than one female because he increases the number of offspring he produces. But from the female's perspective, that could be a really bad thing if, as a consequence of that, he reduces his investment in the well-being of their shared offspring. So that conflict is what Parker starts with. And the reason why sexual conflict is important is because it drives the evolution of a whole suite of adaptations that serve to foster the reproductive interests of an individual of one sex at the expense of the individual of the other sex. And what it leads to is a kind of evolutionary arms race where an adaptation in one sex then serves to select for counter-adaptations in the other that leads to what is referred to as antagonistic co-evolution. Now this idea, on my pointer here, this idea didn't catch on right away. I told you this was kind of an obscure chapter. It was published in 1979. This shows the number of citations over time. And you can see the first few years, people just ignore Parker's work, but you can see that over up to close to the present time, there's literally been an exponential increase in the number of papers that cite this monumental work. And to the extent that when this book that on sexual conflict by Gornarkowitz and Locke Rowe was published in 2005, there are over 1,500 references, most of which deal with studies, empirical studies of sexual conflict. So this is a really growing field. What I want to do today is review some of the empirical evidence in my lab that has identified a number of adaptations that we think have evolved in the context of sexual conflict. And the first one I want to start with is a trait or a tactic that is fairly common in insects, and that is the provision of nuptial food gifts. What is a nuptial food gift? It's a gift of food that the male gives to the female, either just before mating or during mating. And those gifts can come in a whole variety of forms, from insect prey that the male captures, as seen in these hanging flaps, glandular secretions that in this case are coming from a special metanodal gland in the back of the male that the female feeds on. And in extreme cases, and this is an example I'm going to talk about later, it can even involve portions of the male's body that the females consume. A pervasive feature of the overwhelming majority of these gifts is that they give the male access to the female's physiology, because she's ingesting substances which he has synthesized. And the seed that I want to plant in your mind at this point in the talk is that having secured that access, you shouldn't assume that the male's intentions are entirely innocent, that he might not want to manipulate the female's physiology in a way that is commensurate with his reproductive interests, even if it is detrimental to the female's reproductive interests. Well, this is the star of the show, or about the main star of the show. This is a male decorated cricket. Scientific name is Volodes sigillatus. And like the males of other cricket species, the males call, produce acoustic signals to attract females by rubbing together these leathery forewings. This is a male that has succeeded in attracting a female and convincing her to mate. And just so, because I know a lot of you haven't, like me, spent years watching crickets have sex, the male is the individual on the bottom, and the female is the individual on the top. Sperm in crickets, and indeed in many arthropods and other animals, are not transferred in a liquid ejaculate. They're transferred in a discrete vessel, which is called a spermatophore. And you can see the spermatophore here that is extruded almost entirely out of the male's abdomen. And the spermatophore in this species is really unusual in that it consists of two distinct components. There is a small sperm-containing ampulla, this white part here. And then surrounding that, there's a much larger bubble-like, jelly-like portion, which has the awful name of a spermatophylax. And the spermatophylax is, in fact, a nuptial gift which the female consumes after she's mated with the male. So this is a female. What the female does, and that's her mate, focus in the background. As soon as she dismounts the male with that spermatophore attached at the tip of her abdomen, she draws the tip of her abdomen towards her mouth parts, and she attempts to detach the food gift part from the sperm-containing or sperm ampulla part of the spermatophore. And this is a female that has succeeded in doing that. Now you can see quite clearly, I hope, the two parts of the spermatophore. There's the sperm-containing ampulla, and there's the food gift part. And females follow a fairly reliable, rigid rule of thumb with respect to their behavior once they receive this gift. As soon as the female is done consuming the food gift, she repeats that behavior and turns right around and plucks off and eats the sperm-containing ampulla. And that rule of thumb is captured in the data that are reflected in this slide. What this slide shows is the relationship between the time it takes a female to fully consume that nuptial food gift, or more simply, the time spent feeding by the female, and the time after mating that she removes and plucks off that sperm-containing ampulla, or more simply, the duration of ampulla attachment. And the line that I've drawn on here is obviously not a regression line, or Steve Giuliano would beat me. It is, in fact, the line in this plot where the time spent feeding by the female is exactly equal to the duration of ampulla attachment. And the reason why I've drawn it on this plot is to impress on you that the overwhelming majority of these points fall just above that line. And the reason why they do is, regardless of how long it takes the female to consume that food gift, she turns right around a minute or two later and plucks off that sperm ampulla. Now that behavior has potentially profound fitness consequences for the male. And the reason why it does is because we know from sperm transfer studies that it takes approximately 50 to 55 minutes for that sperm ampulla to be emptied of sperm. And what does that mean if we extrapolate from this graph? It means that all of these points underneath this red line represent cases where the female is removing that sperm ampulla before the male has transferred his entire ejaculate. From the male's point of view, that's a bad thing. Now, this rule of thumb gives the female the opportunity to reward generous males and to punish stingy males, and that's captured in the next plot. What this plot shows is the mass of the spermatophore, which the male transfers to the female, and the amount of time it takes her to completely consume that food gift. It says estimated here because we could have waited until that for directly because we're allowing the female to consume that food gift. So we weighed the male immediately before and after mating as a crude surrogate. That mass loss is a crude surrogate of the size of the spermatophore. And it doesn't surprise you at all that larger gifts take longer to consume than smaller gifts. And so that if you're a male and you transfer a large gift to the female, you can expect that you are going to transfer all of your sperm, whereas if you're a male that has transferred a small food gift, you can expect that you're going to be penalized in the form of reduced sperm transfer. Now, we can only consider this mechanism, this built-in mechanism, a kind of quality of control, a form of quality control, if in fact it influences the fertilization success of a male, his ability to fertilize eggs. And at the older we get at that question, we need to be able to do a couple of things. We need to be able to experimentally manipulate the number of sperm that a male transfers to a female. And then we need to have some means of determining the paternity of the offspring a female produces when she's been mated to more than one male. Well, in a paper that we published 10 years ago on an experiment that Anna and I did, we did exactly that kind of experiment. It's very easy to manipulate sperm transfer in crickets because their ejaculate is conveniently placed outside the female's body. So you can remove that anytime you want. And then we use genetic markers to determine the paternity of the offspring. This is a fairly straightforward experiment. We started with virgin females, mated each of them to two different males. The first male was allowed to transfer in a complete ejaculate. We made the female accept the complete ejaculate, we can do that. And then when the second male mated, we removed his spermatophore, prescribed it was after mating. Let the female have babies and determine which male sided the babies. And that's what this graph captures. It captures the proportion of offspring sired by that second male, the one whose sperm were manipulating, as a function of how many sperm that male transfers relative to the first male. That's what this, and I apologize for the jargon, that's just the jargon of people who work in this field. The basic idea here is that as the second male increases the number of sperm transferred relative to the first, he sires an increasing proportion of the offspring. And there's a lot of variation here, but in fact, the number of sperm transferred accounts for about 50% of the variation in paternity. What does that mean? That means that the female has really powerful control over which male sires her offspring by this simple spermatophore removal behavior. And so our conclusion from this work is that this is not really so much a gift as the price of admission. The food gift is really a bribe that the male gives to the female to keep her preoccupied so that he can transfer complete ejaculate. A lot of the work on nuptial gifts have been of this variety. What is its current utility? What is the function of nuptial feeding? And you'll see that the literature is replete with these types of studies now. But I think that focus has ignored a question that's at least, if not more important, and that is how do these gifts evolve in the first place? How do they arise? Well, any hypothesis concerning the origin of food gifts has to account for two widespread features of food gifts. First, in almost every system that's been studied, there is some mechanism, regardless of the taxon, where the female has some means of rewarding males that provide them with bigger gifts. There's always some mechanism there. And then we have to account for the sheer diversity of food gifts that evolves in even closely related taxa. So for example, in the group of insects that I study, the true crickets, there are species where the male transfers a number of spermless spermatophores before he transfers one that contains sperm. The female eats all the ones that precede that. There are species where the male has a special spur on his leg that the female chews off and ingests material formed from that device. There's, I showed you the picture of the tree cricket feeding at the Matanoba plant. There's all kinds of this very rapid evolution of this diversity. Why? What accounts for that? And the hypothesis that we have considered most recently in my lab is that this diversity comes about because of a kind of evolutionary process referred to as sensory exploitation. And the basic idea here is that these food gifts are specifically designed by selection to tap into the, or to invoke the gustatory response of females. They're designed to cause those receptors to respond to the composition of the food gift, so that females are in fact fooled into accepting more sperm than they otherwise would, because this feeding pathway has been engaged, and they're no longer, as it were, thinking as much as an insect can think about the grooming response that results in the loss of the spermatophore. Well, this is a very controversial hypothesis in the evolution of signal traits in males, and there are a set of diagnostic criteria that you have to satisfy before you can even consider this as a workable hypothesis. The first thing you have to show or demonstrate is that the absence of the trait, in this case the absence of the spermatophylax, is the ancestral condition. Well, we know from a recent phylogeny that in fact the ancestral condition in crickets is a naked sperm ampulla without any food gift, and female removal of the ampulla, and this food gift is really a recent innovation. We know that from phylogenetic study. We also need to be able to show that there's a female preference for the trait in a species in which the trait is present. I've already shown you this very simple rule of thumb where females, by the spermatophore removal behavior, favors genus males. And that mechanism, that rule of thumb, is pervasive in gift-giving insects. And then finally, you have to be able to show, and this is the tough one, a female preference for the trait in a species in which the trait is absent. And this is akin to being able to show that this mechanism exists in cricket species that don't have food gifts. Well, as it happens, most crickets don't have food gifts. That spermatophylax is an unusual thing. So the way that we approached that third criterion was to do an experiment in which we mated females of three non-gift-giving species. These are species that only have that tiny sperm ampulla. And we gave them the opportunity to feed on the Grolodes spermatophylax as a foreign, completely novel food gift that they never experienced. And these are the three species here. It doesn't really matter what they are, they're just they're non-gift giving. And the very simple experiment, each of the females were mated twice to the same male. After one mating, we offered up this novel food gift at the end of the dissecting probe, and the other mating was a control mating, the way they normally mate, where they get no food gift. And in half the replicates, they got the food gift first and the control mating second, and then in the other half, that order was reversed to control for any order effect. It was 24 hours between the mates. And this experiment, as designed, makes two fairly strong predictions. It predicts first that the recently mated females of the non-gift-giving species should readily consume these novel food gifts, if indeed they've been designed to be specifically enticing and tasty. And then secondly, it should be true even in these non-gift-giving species that the consumption of the food gift results in the same delay in the removal of the ampulla that we see in the original species that has the food gift. Let's address the first question. Do crickets of these other species eat Grolodes food gifts, these novel food gifts? I mean, the word they do. This is a field cricket, a Grolodes foetus, that's happily frothing over a Grolodes food gift. This is a house cricket, again a different species than the decorated cricket, that has a small remnant left in her mandibles because she's been consuming this for a half an hour. This is a Texas field cricket, Grolodes texensis, that is happily chowing down on Grolodes food gift. How eager are they to consume these food gifts? Well, let me take you through this table one line at a time. If we look at the first line, what it shows is the percent of food gifts eaten that were offered to the females. And you can see that most of them were consumed, from 91% in Grolodes foetus to 100% in Akita domesticus, and the sample sizes are in parentheses. They begin feeding on that food gift when it's offered just a few minutes after you present it to them, so they're very quick to grab these food gifts. And they feed on the food gift anywhere from a median of 30 minutes in this species to 51 minutes in this species, a period of time that's comparable to the actual decorated cricket. Now, I've talked about these data in many talks, and invariably I get a question at the end of the talk where it just goes something like this. So you've got a cricket to eat a piece of food. What do you do? Big deal. What does this prove? And I have now my rejoinder solemnly implies, and that is that if you think it's easy to do this, pick your favorite foodstuff that you think a cripple will like. Piece of ketchup, piece of apple, piece of banana, lettuce, whatever you like. Put it on the end of that second bowl and hold it on in front of the cricket and see if the cricket will voluntarily snatch that off the pole. It doesn't, it just scurries away. Okay, that's what happens, it just scurries away. It is remarkable to do this with these food gifts. You hold it in front of the female, and you can literally see their, they have these labial palps as part of their mouthwash. You can see them start to quiver, and then they just reach out and pluck that off your probe as nifty as could be. They really seem to be designed to invoke exactly that kind of response. Now, the question becomes, does this have an effect on how long females of these non-gift-giving species actually retain their ampulla? And I'm only going to show data from the one species. These are data from the Pitta domesticus. And this is a frequency distribution of the females in the two treatments, those that received the novel food gift after they mated, and those that didn't. Those are the open bars. And you can see that when females receive a food gift, and remember, this is completely novel to them, they retain their mate's ampulla significantly longer than when they didn't, exactly as the hypothesis predicts. But now the acid test is, does this have any effect on sperm transfer? And that's because sperm transfer is the currency that pays off in terms of fertilizations. And here's some data that address this. Slide shows the number of sperm remaining in the sperm ampulla. Actually, this is a sample of sperm. As a function of how long the ampulla remains attached to the female. You can imagine that the longer the ampulla remains attached, more sperm are being pushed out of that ampulla into the female, so there should be fewer sperm remaining in the ampulla with time. And that is indeed exactly what you see, although you get a lot of scatter here. It's invariably the case when you count insect sperm that you get a lot of variation. It just goes with the territory. But there's still a nice strong linear decline, which is what you would expect. And the interesting thing is, this arrow here represents the median ampulla attachment time of the females that did not get a food gift. These are the control females. And this arrow is the median attachment time of the females that did get a food gift. And if you extrapolate over to the y-axis, you can see that the females that got a food gift can expect to have received about twice as many sperm from their partner as they did when you didn't offer them a food gift. Again, exactly as the hypothesis predicts. So, these data are consistent with this idea that these gifts are designed, in fact, to as a kind of sensory trap. But they really don't provide any good evidence of sexual conflict, right? I mean, why should it be bad for the female if something the male officer tastes good and she takes in more sperm? Why should that be a bad thing? It could be a good thing. Well, the evidence that it's a bad thing actually was completely unexpected, and it comes from the same experiment that I just talked about. What this slide shows is another frequency distribution, but this kind shows the length of time it took the female of the non-gift-giving species to remate following their initial mating. Remember, these females were mated twice. Once they got a food gift and once they did not. And in the case where, in their first mating, they got no food gift, the usual control case, the overwhelming majority of those females, this is the black bar, mated the next day at the very first opportunity. Boom, they're happy, they mate again. But note that when they got the novel food gift from the Grilodes in their first mating and then given an opportunity to mate again, that over 50% of those females actually took 2 or 3 days to complete their second mate. They wouldn't mate their first day. You put them in there, the male pours, they don't mate. Now, there's a lot of interesting explanations that one could offer to explain this result. But at least one of those explanations would include the possibility that there is something in that food gift that's acting as an anti-aphrodisiac, that's turning off female sexual receptivity, and that would explain why these females are taking longer to remate than these ones here. Well, if that were true, that would be really sexy. That would be a neat thing to be the case. But what makes this, to me, even more sexier is I've been watching Grilodes, the gift-giving species, mate since I did my PhD on them. I have watched countless meetings in Provost, and I've never seen any indication that the females at the least get turned off when they eat a male spoon gift. So you've got this curious situation where the females, where the food gift evolved, you can make them till the cows come home. That's one of the reasons why I love working with them. It's easy to get them to mate. But it's having this anti-aphrodisiacal effect in a species that doesn't have the food gift. What the heck's going on? Well, the hypothesis that we approached in my lab was we hypothesized that the spermatophyllites, this food gifts, contain substances that functions to inhibit the receptivity of female gorgonias. And you can imagine that's a good thing if you're a male, right? You don't want the female to go off and mate with another male, so you turn her off. But the reason why I'm not seeing an effect of this in Verlodes is that the females in Verlodes have evolved some kind of an immunity to these substances. The reason why females of the non-gift-giving species show a reduction in their sexual receptivity is because having had no evolutionary experience with the consumption of these gifts and the substances that they contain, they've been under no selection to evolve the same level of resistance. That's a great hypothesis. I love this hypothesis, but the data that I've shown you to support it are very weak, completely weak. And they're weak for two reasons. One is, in the previous slide that I showed you with the time for remating, not only did females either get a gift or not get a gift, they received different amounts of sperm, right? That was one of the results of the study. So it might be that whatever's causing the decrease in receptivity is actually contained in the ejaculate. You know, that's true in the softball, for example. Maybe not in the gift at all. And then the other thing is it's been my anecdotal impression that gorgonias are not influenced by the consumption of their mate's food gifts. But my anecdotal impression is not worth a hill of beans. And you need real data. That's just not good enough. So we did a properly controlled experiment where we actually equalized, did the same thing as before. You get a food gift sometimes and you don't get a food gift. Other females don't get a food gift. And we equalized sperm transfer across treatments. And then we also experimentally precluded some female gorgonias from feeding on these food gifts. And here are the results of this study. This is the data, forget about these for now. These are the data for the non-gift-giving species. This graph shows the percent of the females that remain unmated as a function of the total cumulative courtship time that the male spends trying to get her to mate. And this trajectory here is the trajectory that one sees when they've consumed the food gift beforehand, and this is the trajectory that you get when they haven't consumed the food gift. And you can see that there's a real difference between those two trajectories. It's highly significant statistically. And if we were just to sort of compare at one point, it takes about 70 minutes of total cumulative courtship for 50% of the females in the group that's received the food gift to complete that second mating. But if you don't get a food gift, why, you remate within 15 minutes of cumulative total courtship. If you do the same experiment kind of in the gift-giving species, where we don't give them food gifts, we take them away, and take a look at what effect that has, it has no effect. So these data basically support the hypothesis that I presented earlier. Essentially what males are doing is they're lacing their food gifts, probably with an accessory gland protein that is turning on female receptivity. But because we know in crickets through a whole host of studies that multiple mating by females is highly beneficial to the females have evolved an immunity to those anti-aphrodisiacal substances. It's really kind of a cool thing. Now, I love that body of work, but it lacks a smoking gun. I mean, we haven't identified the potential protein that may be having this effect. So what I want to do now is consider an example where the adaptation is a little more concretely identified. And now I'm going to turn to another system that we work with in my lab that involves sexual conflict in sagebrush crickets. The sagebrush cricket, Cypanderis stepitans is its legal name, is not a true cricket at all. It's a member of a really obscure family of cricket-like insects that the fossil record shows was once very diverse and widely distributed, and which is now nearly extinct. And there are only three relevant species remaining in all of North America, all of which occur in sort of the western U.S. and Canada. And this is the one we study, the sagebrush cricket, and that is a male, just like the decorated cricket, who's calling to attract females. We do this work, the field work, out in Grand Teton National Park, where the species tends to occur in high-altitude sagebrush meadows. The breeding season is very short. It begins in mid-May, lasts around June, and then they're done. And there are nocturnal species like most crickets. They call from dusk to around midnight when it gets too cold, and then they go back into the litter. This photograph is taken above my main study site, which is right along the bench of the Snake River, which you can see sort of in the background, and there's the Grand Teton's in the background. I love the system, and as you can imagine, I'm always eager to go out there and continue work, and the difficult thing is getting the students to come back to Central Illinois. This was a group that I took out there in 2003. Well, here's another mating unit. You see one mating, the same sort of deal. The male's the one on the top, the male's the one on the bottom, the female's on the top, and the female in this slide is actually engaged in nuptial feeding, even though you can't tell. You may notice, however, that the front of her mouthparts are conveniently tucked underneath these calling wings. What the female is doing, although you can't see it, is she's chewing on the hind wings of the male, which in this species is very desirable. They're very fleshy. And here's a virgin male here. And what the female does when she's mounted on him is she chews on these wings, she breaks through the integument, the male starts to bleed, and then she ingests that hemolymph. So it's pretty tough stuff from the male. And here you can see a non-virgin male, and you can see that the female does a pretty awful number on those hind wings. She really wreaks quite a bit of damage on those hind wings. This is another mating. You can't see enough cricket mates in the sample pool. Again, this is the male, this is the female, but what distinguishes this mate from the other one is that the female in this slide is desperately trying to get away. She's pulling back. She's mounted this male, but then after mounting him, she's decided, no, I don't want to mate with you, and she wants to pull away before he transfers that spermatophore. But, and it's hard to see from where you are, she's being held. The male's pinching her, and he's pinching her between two adjacent segments right there. See the underside of her abdomen, right where my ear goes, and that's where she's being pinched by the male. And if you look a little more carefully at that part of the male's body, the male has this fierce-looking structure that's revealed here with a scanning electron micrograph. That's this thing here. That's what's holding that female in place, even though she wants to get away. It's called the gin trap, and it consists of two pairs of reef curved spines that, when the male tips the tip of his abdomen upwards to secure genitalia contact, those two spines, sets of spines, come together and go plunk, and latch onto the female, and this is just the side you are lateral from. Well, I think an obvious explanation for the evolution of this device is that it perhaps functions to prevent females from feeding opportunistically on males. After all, when a female mounts you and chews on those hind wings, you lose blood, you lose part of your soma. We know that males are compromised in terms of their ability to sing afterwards. So maybe this structure has evolved to prevent females from doing that to males. Yeah, because a female doesn't care when she's mated, she can go around and just go trolling for meals. Well, the way we did this was with a simple experiment. I always tell my students, I love simple, mindless experiments because those are the only ones that I can understand. If it gets too complicated, I don't do it because I can't interpret them. So in this experiment, we manipulated the hindwing condition of the male. That is, we left his wings intact or we removed them entirely at the very moment. And then we also manipulated the condition of that gin trap. We either left it intact or disabled it by surgically removing those spines so that the male can no longer clamp onto the female. And then because these guys behave in slow motion, they might take all night to mate. We had to use time-lapse video photography or recording. Or, depending on if it's a bad year, the student stays up there and watches them all night, they actually record the mating behavior. And here are the results of this experiment. What this experiment shows is the percent of all the males in these different treatments that actually made it over the course of the night. And I think this is purple. I can get these colors wrong, but it's sort of purple. That represents those males whose gin trap was disabled. And the white bars represent those males whose gin trap was left intact. And this shows results when the male's hindwings were left intact, and this shows results when the male's hindwings were removed. And what this data really show is that our opportunistic feeding hypothesis was wrong. It's not why, apparently, this organ has evolved. Because you can see that when the male has a nuptial gift to offer, his hindwings and blood, it doesn't matter whether he has a gin trap. It was a virtual dead tie. You don't need a gin trap if you can feed the female. But when you remove the hind wings and you can no longer feed the female, you can see there's a dramatic reduction in mating success. But at least those males that have an intact gin trap still get some mates. When you don't have the ability to feed the female and you don't have the ability to clamp her, you get zero mates. So our revised explanation for these results is that the gin trap has evolved as sort of a backup contingency for when males have been completely chewed to the nub. It enables them to keep the female clamped on long enough so that even males that can't feed females can transfer the spermatophore. So they get some, it's insurance, they get some mating success. All right, last little story, and this deals with the third taxon I want to talk about, and that deals with sexual conflict in burying beetles. Burying beetles are called burying beetles because they bury the carcasses of small vertebrates or birds as the sole food source for their young. They're burying beetles. And here, a male-female pair of burying beetles happily burying a carcass. Most of this work on burying beetles has been done in collaboration with Newt Muller, who was my sabbatical host for 2 sabbaticals in Germany, and then my wife, Anna, shown here in a forest near Freiburg. In fact, I'm really the second fiddle in this research. Anna's really the driver of this research, but I'm going to pretend that I'm the big shot, for this occasion at least. Burying beetles are tremendously interesting insects because they're one of the few arthropods that exhibit true biparental care, where both the male parent and the female parent actively invest in the care of their young. That's kind of an astonishing thing for an insect to do. And here's the male and female. What they do is they prepare the carcass by stripping all the fur off it, and they roll it into a really tight, compact carrion ball. And you can sort of tell this used to be a mouse. There's a tail coming out there, right? And then the parents excavate this sort of cavity at the top of the carrion ball where the offspring will live and feed on the carcass from the inside out. The parents will defend the carcass against predators, defend the carcass against conspecific competitors, and they even feed the young. So these are 13 star larvae, and what you're seeing here, this larva here is rearing up, exposing its mandibles, presenting its mandibles to its mom or dad, I can't tell which, and what the mom or dad has done is they have fed somewhat on this carrion, partially digesting the carrion, and then they regurgitate this sort of slurry back to the larva. It's sort of a, here's your meal. Hope you enjoyed the dinner at the president's house. It's too rude, right? This is another reproductive unit. Here's another, this carrion ball is sort of in bad shape, but you use what you need to use. But this is unusual, well, not so much unusual, but this is a different kind of relationship than I wanted to show you. Because if you count, although typically we think of burying beetles as monogamous, there's a single male and a single female, there's three adults here. This is a polygynous arrangement. There is one male here, and there are two females here. And you can imagine, this is a great deal for the male. It's a great deal because frequently carcasses are large enough to support the offspring of more than one female, or that the eggs that are produced by more than one female, so that from a male's perspective, you leave more offspring if you can attract a second female. But, and this is important, but this can be a really bad deal for the female, because although a carcass may be large enough to support the young of more than one female, frequently they're sort of in between. They support the young of more than one female, but less than two females. So that if you're a female and another female comes along, that may depress your own reproductive success, even if the male that has both females is enjoying an increase in his reproductive success. Well, males seem to be aware of the situation, and when you present them with a carcass that's large enough to support the eggs or offspring of more than one female, they engage in sneaky polygynous signaling. Now, this is a male, and I know he's a male because he's got this curious headstand posture. What he's doing is he's calling out in a curious kind of way for another female. You don't know if there's another person. He's already got a female. But he's still signaling. The way he does this is he averts his last abdominal segment. There are glands in that last abdominal segment that emit a volatile odor that attracts females from a long distance away. Because he's trying to get another mate. Now, the female that's on here doesn't like this deal. And so that female, when she smells, and they have a very keen sense of smell, the female immediately stops what she's doing, and in this case runs over and climbs up on top of the male to sort of dissuade him from signaling. Now, she might do that, or, and this is a little hard to see, but here, this is the male. The female will come along and try to undercut him so that he topples over and he can no longer in that pheromone-emitting stance. Or if the female gets really, truly grumpy, she will, in fact, attack the male. So this is the male. This is the female here. And you can maybe be able to see here, her mandibles are wide open. She's trying to bite his abdomen. He's really annoyed that he's trying to signal. And he's getting grumpy back as he's kicking her back with his hind legs to try to get her to go away. Now, the most parsimonious explanation for this is that this suite of behaviors by the female has evolved specifically to discourage this kind of surreptitious, or not so surreptitious, polygynous signaling by the male. But how do you actually test that? How do you test the idea that that's why these set of behaviors have evolved in this fashion? Well, the way that Alan and I did it is he tied up the females. this is a female that's been tied up with dental floss. And she's been tied in such a way that she can get around the carcass, all right. The tether's long enough that she can get around the carcass, but she can't, it's restricted so she can't get at the male who's signaling a few centimeters away from the carcass. And then we had another group of females, a control group, where they also had this tether, but we cut it off here so that the female is still free to run around wherever she wants. Again, I told you, like simple-minded experiments. All right. What effect does that treatment have on the interference behavior of the female? Well, the black bars represent when the female is untethered. The lighter bars represent when the female is tethered. And you can see when the female is untethered, the number of interference attempts she engages in is far higher than when she's tethered. Why? Because when you're tethered, you can only attack the male when he's in reach of the carcass. And what the male does, of course, is as soon as he figures out he's being attacked, he just swoops off a little ways, sticks his rear end up in the air, and starts to signal him. What effect does this behavior have on the pheromone emission of the male? Because that's the acid test. Come on now. Well, it's the exact opposite pattern, as you would expect, right? So when the females are tethered, the amount of pheromone emission, and this is a frequency distribution for the duration of pheromone emission, the time that the male is invested in pheromone emission is way higher than when the female is untethered. When the female is untethered, a lot of the males don't pheromone emit at all because the females basically beat them into obedience. I mean, the females would like this part of the story. So, in conclusion, I hope I convinced you that sexual conflict is a normal and variable part of reproductive interactions between the sexes. It is almost invariable. And that conflict invariably leads to adaptations that are detrimental to individuals of the other sex. So that these traits are best understood not because they foster some kind of harmonious relationship between the sexes or because they're for the benefit of the species. They evolve because they're the net result of an evolutionary arms race between males and females. I want to end with a couple of acknowledgments. And first, I want to acknowledge
that students have had over the years. I've had just absolutely terrific, stellar students that have really enriched my life. And Tracy already showed this picture. I want to actually identify two graduate students in particular who have just really been instrumental in moving my research forward. And that's been Tracy Ivy, who introduced me today, a PhD student, former PhD student in my lab. And Carrie Reddell, who's just been terrific, a rock in my lab. And they've been the best PhD students that a person anywhere could want to have. My work's been supported really generously by the National Science Foundation. I've been funded more or less continuously since about 1991. I'm very grateful for that support. And over two sabbaticals, I've been supported by research fellowships from the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation. And that's been very helpful as well. Finally, I want to thank my mom and dad. They instilled values in me that perhaps had nothing to do with the fact that I'm a distinguished professor, but more importantly, values that I hope have made me a better person. People have asked me about my name from time to time, not only how to pronounce it, but where does that come from? The Charlie Thompson, when I got hired, he thought I was an Eskimo. That's what he wrote. He had to fill out the affirmative action form on the basis of my application. He said I was an Eskimo. Sakala, the name Sakala is Ukrainian. And translated from Ukrainian, it means literally falconer. That is an individual who uses trained falcons to hunt. And I think you would agree that my father hunted or caught himself a fairly pretty bird here in my mother. My mother's maiden name is Armstrong. And she comes from the part of the Armstrong clan that got thrown out of Scotland and banished to Ireland. So she's actually from the Irish side of the Armstrong clan. And the Armstrong clan has a motto. Clan motto, Invictus Manea. And that motto means I remain unvanquished. And I think if you ask a number of my colleagues, they would say that that is a motto that Scott Sadler has tried to live his professional life by. I remain unvanquished. And if President Baldwin would forgive the presumption, I would think that in the 150th birthday year of this splendid university, that we, as an academic community, remain unvanquished. And with that, I'll say thank you once again. And I think I have time for a question or two. Thank you so much. Well, who wants to be bold and brassy? Yeah, way back there.
Going back to the
this is the kind of lecture is, I really couldn't tell you nearly all the experiments we've done on this species. We did an experiment on decorated crickets where we looked at the nutritional value of those food gifts, and it turns out that they're essentially a complete sham. They have no real nutritional value, so that even if you starve females and feed them food gifts all they want, they have no greater survival or reproductive success than females that haven't been fed food gifts. So what we concluded, and that was an experiment that was done by a master student many years ago, what we concluded is that the food gift is in fact a sham. It's the cricket equivalent of a gummy bear, something that tastes really good, but has no nutritional value. Yeah?
So the food gift comes from like inside the male?
Yes, if you, and I have done this, it probably goes slow, but if you dissect the male, you'll see inside his abdomen, the two most prominent structures are his testes, which are huge, and then even bigger than that, there's this huge mass of, they look like little worms, tubules, clusters of tubules, and they are the accessory glands. And it's those accessory glands, and they're all complicated and weird, and I wouldn't know how to sort them out, but they secrete the substances that ultimately form the sperm ampulla and that form the food gift.
But how exactly that takes place, nobody really knows, and nobody's really looked at that. Yeah? I beg your pardon?
I'm a little confused on how the females were absorbing the sperm ampulla.
The sperm ampulla. Well, I didn't really describe this either, but the way that sperm are pushed into the female's reproductive tract is through osmotic pressure that builds up within that sperm capsule, that sperm ampulla. Once it's transferred to the female, if you were to pull that off and put that under a dissecting microscope, it looks literally like a miniature fire hose. That's the force with which the ejaculate is being pushed out through this tiny little spermatophore tube. So the way the contents of that ampulla get inside the female is they're forcefully expelled from the ampulla. The way the female gets the remnants of the ampulla is, as I pointed out, she just turns around and eats it. Yeah, Al.
It's easy for a funding scholar to move, and I'd be interested in hearing why you decided to say it. I don't want to say
it. I'll be honest, in the very early years, I wasn't. In the very early years, I thought I wanted to go someplace else, and I wanted to go back to Canada, for example, because the early years, my heart really wasn't here. It wasn't in this country, much less in this community. But once you have children, and once you start to make a community relationship, and the most, by far, the most important thing in my life that kept me here is there's a group of colleagues in the biology department with which I've interacted with over the years that make life in that department that has been a sheer intellectual joy. And it's just the collegiality with those. It's a big department. It's not like I, warm fuzzy feelings for everybody, but there's a core of people. there's a core of people who, when you go to work, it makes life an absolute joy. And I sort of alluded to this in the little write-up I did for my bio. Early on, I had good mentorship from Charlie Thompson, who just said, Sackler, why don't you just sort of learn to be successful and happy here? He said, why do you think the grass is going to be greener? And you know what? He was right. I've had an absolutely wonderful career here, and I am really glad that I stayed. But it's probably a longer answer than you wanted, but that's the answer. All right. I don't have the script.
Someday. And what I learned tonight is never schedule the dinner after the lecture. So that's the rule. As president of Illinois State, I'm very pleased to be here to honor one of our most esteemed faculty members, distinguished Professor Scott Sokolow. Dr. Sokolow's scholarly work has earned him a reputation for excellence among his colleagues, and we are honored to have him as a member of our faculty. Illinois State has an important mission to fulfill in the world of higher education. This mission includes significant contributions in the areas of teaching, research, and public service. And at Illinois State, we are fortunate to have faculty members who dedicate their careers to this threefold mission. This faculty, through its conveyance of knowledge to others, its discovery of new knowledge through research, and its application of knowledge to help solve societal problems, has achieved a reputation for excellence that is the foundation of the university. Numbered among this faculty, however, are certain individuals whose reputations for excellence are recognized both nationally and internationally, and whose achievements place them at the forefront of their chosen disciplines. These outstanding individuals are designated as the Distinguished Professors of Illinois State. Distinguished professors come from a wide variety of disciplines: education, the fine arts, applied science and technology, the humanities, the social sciences, and the natural sciences. However, these outstanding individuals share at least one common attribute. They are among the very best at what they do. An important component of the educational experience available to students at Illinois State is the opportunity to study with and learn from distinguished professors and to benefit from the knowledge and expertise that these scholars bring to the classrooms, laboratories, and studios of our great university. This series, of which tonight's program is a part, provides the university with the opportunity to showcase and honor its finest faculty members. Because Dr. Sakalak is an honored member of his department, his college, and the university as a whole, I'd like to invite Provost Presley, Dean Gary Olson, and Dr. Tak Chung to join me at the lectern so we can move his award.